And I want to acknowledge Gazette Newspapers that makes it possible for us to have this lecture series. We brought tonight's speaker in all the way from Long Beach, outskirts of Long Beach, at great expense, right? Ty Bowman is a photographer, a professional musician, artist, teacher, and if you haven't seen his photographs up on the second floor, you should. They will be there through December 1st, and they're wonderful photographs. Ty received a degree in photojournalism and a Bachelor of Fine Arts from the University of Texas in Austin, a Master of Fine Arts in printmaking from North Texas State University. He's worked as a sculptor, he's taught digital illustration and animation at Cerritos College. His photographs have been exhibited at TAG Gallery in Santa Monica, and he served as artist-in-residence in the Grand Canyon National Park for 3 weeks last month. And images from this period are part of the exhibition upstairs. And we've gotten to know Ty over the last year. We had a wonderful discussion with him over dinner. He's a very engaging, important artist, and we're delighted to have him here at the Aquarium. Please welcome Ty Bowman.
Well, thank you, Jerry, for the introduction, and thank you for allowing me to exhibit the work at the Aquarium. It's quite an honor. And it's good to see all of you here tonight. Thank you for coming, and it's a pleasure. So, I did do a project at the Grand Canyon. I was the artist in residence. It's a real honor. It's an honor of a lifetime, actually. It's the highlight of my art career. It's very, very special. I'll talk more about that. But I first want to start off with a video. It's not very long. It's a minute. It goes fast. So you got to watch closely. It's kind of a rousing start to it. I will say that it's a project that I didn't do, but I'll explain more about that in a minute. Self-referential, and I'll explain more about the project, but I'll just set up what the lecture will be. It's talk about the project and my early work. Oops. Now I'm stuck.
I don't know how to.
All right. Oh, you gotta press.
This guy has a little trigger.
Exactly.
You can just push it advance
right
here. That little trigger.
Right.
So hit it again.
Okay. I'll talk about something called post-environmentalism. I'll use my life as an example of what was going on at the time, back in the 50s and 60s. That's me on the left 40 years ago, and that's me emerging from the canyon this past April. I'll talk about some of the environmental factors at the Grand Canyon National Park. This is a California condor. The number is because it's a breeding program. And then I'll go into a few factors of global environmental factors and our worldview. Talk more about the power of art in shaping our worldview. And take a look at the depiction of nature throughout art history and how that plays into our worldview. And then finally, I'll get to my work from the Canyon and Taos and overseas. So, about the project. The original project was to do a comparison between the pristine wilderness on the right and, let's say, pollution or something that wasn't so man-made effects of the environment on the left. And so I had proposed to do go to the canyon, take the wilderness, and take, I don't know, whatever sort of pollution and garbage and effects of man on the canyon, and also come back to Los Angeles and take more pictures of pollution and whatnot. But I had a year and a half to do research on the project, and I found that there was a change in environmentalism. And so I decided to focus more on our worldview, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. But first, let me just show you the artist's apartment there. It's a wonderful place. It's a, like I said, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and all the artists in residence leave their mark on this. They have a journal there, and they have artwork from all the past residencies. It's a four-bedroom apartment with a studio. And then when you go out to the left, you're on a deck, and then you see the view of the canyon there. It's just gorgeous. And then all the Europeans and all the French and the Italians and the Swiss and the Germans and the Russians and then all the nationalities over in El Tovar are staying, and so they come out, and that's where they all come out, and you can see the canyon. So I was going to do this comparison between the pristine nature and the spoiled nature, I suppose. And I found out that there had been a shift in the environmental movement, and I really wanted to talk, instead of doing a 70s-style lecture on pointing the finger at what's wrong with the environment, I wanted to do something that would get at the root cause of maybe why we're unmotivated to do much about things like global warming. But this is in the vein of work that I had started 25 years ago. I came to Los Angeles in 87, and by 89 I had done this work. It's, I don't know if you can tell, it's made out of tires. I'd never seen so many cars coming to LA, so it was about the cars, it was about the traffic, it was about the people and the palm trees, and I just put it all together, and this was my art. And I did a project, this was a proposal for cultural affairs department with the city of Los Angeles to do a temporary construction fence. So this is reflecting again all of the crowdedness and all the street signs and all the people and everything taking over LA. This was a proposal. This was the first tire man. It's kind of a tire lizard man or something. So this is what got me going. And this was in my driveway up in North Hollywood, and some guy in a Jaguar honks, says, "Yeah, way to go." And I thought, well, okay, so I'll keep going. And a couple years later, 91, I assembled this sculpture that's me up there on the lift, all these tire men at the College of Santa Fe in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where my friends live. And they have a sculpture competition there every year, so I got invited. The local telephone, the power company, drilled holes and sunk these telephone poles. So that's what those are. They're at a 15-degree angle, even though the camera sort of changes the angle, but they're at a 15-degree angle outward. And then you can see my friends and I down at the bottom to give you scale. So this is like 35 or 40 feet. And then a sculpture park picked it up, and I was still going with the tire theme. So So at this time, tires, the tire material became, I guess you could say, my signature material, and I just latched onto it and just kept going with it. This was in the mid 90s, and I actually did a big commission for one of his clients, and it went off to France. I was looking for it 2 years ago in Nice, and I couldn't find it. But this is a three-dimensional lady tire figure. This is a tire chair, actually. It's a rocking chair. It rocks on a big auto coil spring. And it's about 8 feet tall. It's upholstered with tires. You can see my friend Ray sitting in it to give it the scale there. And then I carried it indoors with more tire upholstered furniture and then tire printed chairs and it just carried the theme on and on and on. And then I started printing with it. I made little block prints out of tire treads and inked it up and put it on. This is paper that's about 3 by 5 feet. And I did an exhibition that in the armory in Santa Fe. This was a proposal for a project that never got made, but it was along the same lines of using tires as a metaphor for the environment, pollution of the environment, and plastic bags and so on. And it was about recycling and that sort of thing. Then, so in my research, I came across these gentlemen. They've already lectured here at the aquarium, so I won't say much about it. Ted Nordhaus and Michael Schellenberger, they wrote a book called Breakthrough. They have an institute called Breakthrough. And they noticed something about the environmental movement. It wasn't really doing a whole lot for the environment as far as affecting change in issues, let's say, global warming, because that's almost an insurmountable issue, but we still have to do it. But anyway, the narrative, they wanted to change the narrative from the politics of limits to the politics of possibilities. So instead of making it a sort of blame and shame game and single issue politics like save the whales or save the ozone, although those were really important movements and we need that, they recognized that there was a need for jobs, creating jobs, a transition to a clean energy economy, and profitability. So what I decided to focus on was a project that would get at to the root of the issue of our beliefs, our core beliefs. If you want to change your behavior, you have to first change your beliefs. So I wanted to see what our core beliefs are. So the purpose of this project was to inspire a worldview that leads to greater stewardship of life on Earth. And I emphasize life on Earth because when someone says, oh, well, I want to be a good steward of the Earth, sometimes I just think of, well, a geography and the land and the ocean and the air. But really, we're talking about life that lives there on the land and the ocean and the air. And hopefully I'd like to demonstrate how art holds the power to reconnect us with wilderness and change our worldview. So that's what I'm going to attempt tonight. So you can think of these as barriers to overcoming an issue like global warming. I'll just take global warming as an example, but it could be any environmental issue. I'll take a look at the lack of awareness. Could be an educational route. I've already talked about this, the economic route with the Breakthrough Institute. There could be a philosophical route, the booming economy in which I grew up in. There was a lot of naivety and arrogance over nature. I'll talk about a possible evolutionary and biological route. The media and consumerism could be considered a cultural route. And then as in art history, I'm going to take a look at the depiction of nature and see if there's been a transition there that we can point to. I would suggest it's from a divine presence to mainly urban art. And then finally, our relationship with nature, we can consider it a psychological route. So, as I said, there I am. This is my 40-year anniversary with the canyon. I can, okay, so going way back, here we are in Dallas. I grew up in Dallas. This is with my younger brother on the left and dad. And I guess we needed to do pipes like granddad did, I guess. He smoked a pipe. I look at this and I think, wow, this is just, it looks like at the time anyway, you would think it's just the typical American family. It's living the American dream, and that's exactly what we were doing. We were caught up in the American dream. Dad had a good job, and mom didn't have to work. She was a stay-at-home mom, and she raised three kids. She was very, very proud. You can see that in the photo. And it was a great life, and we didn't really think much about the environment or talk much about it. And so there was a lot of naivete and just unaware of what was going on. We did have an exchange student from Kuwait, Kareem, and that was mom's idea. Actually, we learned a lot through that experience. This is dad working summers in college. He was an outdoorsy kind of guy. This is in Alaska. He's doing geophysical surveys, collecting seismic data for oil exploration. His undergraduate degree was in geology, and his doctoral degree was in geophysics. And this is the title page from his thesis: Scattering of Seismic Waves by Small Inhomogeneities. Now, I've spoken to some of his colleagues. Dad has long since passed. I spoke with some of his colleagues who worked with him at MIT and afterwards in the field, and they told me it's wave theory, and what Dad was doing was the early work of removing the noise from the seismic data that was collected out in the field so you can get an accurate picture of the substrata of the Earth. So a lot of wave theory math. So this is the idea. It's now called deconvolution. My friend David is a geologist, and this is, he told me, yeah, well, that's what Dad worked on. Your dad worked on, Ty, and he works with people who knew my dad, and it's a tight-knit community. But anyway, so this would be a model of the Earth, and this is what the signal that you would want, but this is what you get. But after you apply Dad's formulas or ones that came later afterwards, you would get an accurate picture of more of the ideal response. So that a geologist, you would get this printout, and a geologist would be able to tell the oil company, oh, you need to drill here, and so that they could read the map. And here he is lecturing. He's spent his career at Texas Instruments and processing seismic data. I once asked him, Dad, what's going to happen when oil runs out? And his answer was, oh, well, oil is going to last 200 years. So that was kind of the end of that discussion, and I accepted that answer at the time, it seemed perfectly logical. Dad was an oil engineer, oil is going to last 200 years. It's kind of thing, well, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it, I guess. I don't know, but it didn't exactly work out that way. My brother on the left has been an energy engineer. He works on saving energy for big corporations and their office buildings. He's been talking about peak oil for 30 years. So it's really something that slowly over the years we've had to become aware of it, but at the time we were just really naive and innocent and ignorant, really, of the issues. But as you can see, we caught the outdoor spirit from Dad, and We got into scouting after this. The family got heavily into canoeing. Here we are on the White River in Missouri catching trout. That's Granddad. And I think this is the Big Piney in Arkansas. This is the Ouachita in Arkansas, I think. Here we dumped the canoe and Mom got upset, so we had to make camp and dry everything out. And the scout troop. So I was in scouting 5 years and made Eagle Scout, and we created our own summer camps, and you can see all the canoes in the background. So we were heavily into canoeing. We scouted these rivers, and then we went on and held the summer camp every summer. So it was really a great experience. And I consider it my first degree in the outdoors. But you know, when you go on a camp out every single month, you get a really, and you spend the night out in the woods, you really get a good feeling of nature and get a good connection with nature. Here we are at the Rio Grande in Big Bend, and we were about to run Mariscal Canyon. That's in 69, and then 5 years later, my friend and I from college went to visit his folks in Phoenix. And so while he stayed in Phoenix to talk to his folks, I said, oh, hey, I'm just going to go up the Grand Canyon and go for a hike. So it was the dead of winter. It was 5 degrees, and my water bottle froze solid. But I went anyway. I just walked into the backcountry office, and there was no one there, and here's a permit. And it's not that way today. You need 4 months in advance, and it's a lottery. But so here I am going down the Grand Canyon. I guess I was airing out my gear. If you haven't seen the bridges over the river, they're really impressive. And the tunnel that they have to cut through to get to the bridge, so those are impressive. And I had to swap out my boots for these cowboy boots that grip the snow. I wasn't prepared for the snow at the top of the trail, and the other hiking boots didn't work. They did okay, except I had some blisters, and I had to tape those up. But here's at the bottom. Here's Phantom Ranch, but you can still see there's a jet going overhead still back then. And then this past April, I hiked 64 miles in the canyon in 9 days. So, what are some of the environmental factors at the Grand Canyon? These are California condor. They're really proud of their captive breeding program. They're numbered because these were bred in captivity. The condors almost went extinct. 1985, there were 9 birds, and they were dying from lead poisoning. They were dying from eating dead carcasses that had been shot with lead bullets, and cyanide poisoning set for coyotes. They were dying from power lines and also just general habitat degradation. But now they have around 400 birds, and about half of those are in the wild. And you can see them in the canyon today. The effects of erecting Glen Canyon Dam, it cooled the water about 6 degrees and killed off some of the fish species in the river below. The other thing it did was it stopped all the spring floods. The high flow in the spring would bring all the silt down and build up the beaches and create habitat for the aquatic life. They've tried to experiment with high flow events in the spring to sort of emulate that and stir up the silt and build up the beaches again. But they have lost some of that ability to do that. They have contracts they have to fulfill with the water downstream. Fire suppression in the park. There's been the Park Service has decided to let some of the lightning strikes, the fires that it creates, continue to burn. And it's done controlled burns, And it's actually removed some of the underbrush, because what happens when you have a lot of fire suppression, what will happen is the brush will grow too high, and then the forest fire will get out of control and be worse than it would otherwise. There are non-native species in the park, so they enlist the help of volunteers to remove those by hand. This is Sahara mustard. There's a coal-fired power plant just north of the park, and the Park Service asked, it's on a Navajo reservation, it asked the Navajo Nation to install some scrubbers on the smokestack so it would reduce the emissions. Speaking of which, this is actually the canyon there. You can't see it because of all of the haze. So what they'll have pollution coming up from LA and other metro areas on the jet stream. So in order to solve their problems at the canyon, they've got to come down to LA and solve our problems. So there's not a whole lot they can do about that. The aircraft noise. They've created no-fly zones over the canyon, certain parts, and limited the hours because that was just too much of a nuisance. This is a picture I took. So you can still see high up above jets trailing over the canyon. That hasn't changed. And so I don't think there's any effort to change that. It doesn't really make all that much noise. It's just an interesting fact that when 9/11 happened and all the jets were grounded for 3 days, it gave scientists an opportunity to measure the effects of global warming, and they figured out there was something they've called global dimming from these jet trails that have actually masked the effects of global warming. It's actually a little worse than they originally thought. Uranium mining. So, yeah, along the Tonto Trail, there was an uranium mine, and the ranger told me, don't drink the water there, it's contaminated. So that was a dry camp. Luckily, I didn't camp there. I went through it, but you've got to carry enough water to get from one camp to the next. But there's literally hundreds of uranium mines on mostly on Navajo lands. I read an article recently, there was 500 mines on Navajo lands and one had been cleaned up. So there's a lot more work. And the brown indicates a uranium mine. This is a picture I took. So the rainy season, and it was the rainy season when I was there, just at the end, but climate change has moved the rainy season later into the year. And there's about 4.5 million tourists a year that come to the canyon. The infrastructure there is hard-pressed to take all of that traffic. They thought it was going to be higher than that. It was climbing and climbing. Thought it was going to peak out much higher. But so in anticipation of that, they were going to build a light rail that parked all the cars, and they were going to take a rail into the park. That never happened, but they did end up building the terminal station, and now that's a visitor center. And by the way, the average visit is like 3 hours, and most people don't go down but a mile or two. But to me, I mean, if you're really going to experience the canyon, you're really going to get close to nature, you got to spend a night in the canyon. And I don't know this. It's just my opinion. It's people going there and treating it like a theme park, and that's just one experience of nature, but you really need a deeper experience. So looking at a three global environmental factors, just to take it further, this was last month, the People's Climate March. This is a graph of population predictions based on fertility rates. So it's hard to predict what the population will be in 2100, but that gives you a range, 6 to 15.8 billion. This is a chart that has to do with overconsumption. So what this means is if everyone consumed as much as we do in the U.S., live the same lifestyle that we have, it would take five Earths to supply all of that. Another way of thinking about this is it takes the Earth 5 years to recover from using all of those resources, and that includes safely absorbing carbon dioxide. And the global average right now is 1.4 Earths, or like a year and 5 months to recover. Obviously not sustainable. Global warming, I'm calling this the granddaddy of them all, I guess. It trumps everything else. We've warmed the Earth 0.8 degrees centigrade, and predictions are it could be 6 degrees by 2100 with disastrous effects. So we really need to do something quickly. Someone decided to do a poll, actually, in 07 and 08 and figure out how many people actually know about global warming. And turns out a third of the population from these 127 countries were unaware or had no opinion. That's pretty alarming. So in order to fix a problem, you have to first know about it. This gentleman, Yale Wilson, preeminent scientist, wrote a book, The Future of Life, in which he suggests a biological route, that we haven't been adapted for long-term thinking. And he says to look neither far ahead nor far afield is elemental in a Darwinian sense. So he's talking about hunter-gatherers and early man that just fended for themselves, their own family, their own clan, their own tribe in a small geographic area. Those were favored for procreation, and that's who we're descended from. This lady, Rachel Carson, wrote a book in 62, Silent Spring, talking about pesticides. Her opinion was that it was the post-war culture of science that arrogantly claimed dominion over nature as a philosophic root. Well, I grew up in that time, and it was a boom time, and like I said, we weren't really thinking about the environment. We were thinking about, see the USA in a Chevrolet and having fun, and it was a great time. It was a great life. We had all the material wealth we needed. E.O. Wilson again suggests that we evolved here, one among many species across millions of years, and exist as one organic miracle linked to others. So he's suggesting we are linked to every other species, and we're letting species go extinct and causing that. And this is our relationship with nature. We need to take a hard look at that and revisit that. I would go, this is my slide. I would take it a step further and say, well, just on an elemental level, if you just want to look at the mass of 99% of the human body, we're made up of six elements. So you could argue we are the Earth. And all life on Earth, everything we see around us, consists of various combinations of 92 elements that we learned in chemistry class, and here they are. So what is all this about separation from nature? Jonas Salk wrote a book, 1973, Survival of the Wisest. And when I hear a phrase like that, I immediately think of the common phrase, survival of the fittest. And I wanted to take a look at that and found out that, well, when I think of an animal that's survival of the fittest, it's like a tiger in the jungle that is the most ferocious and can, at the top of the food chain, can gobble up and scare off all the other animals in the forest. But it doesn't really mean that. It means an organism that is most fitted to its environment. And Our environment is changing. We're changing it. This is an analogy of maybe being fitted or actually not fitted to your environment. This is a sign they have up in the backcountry office. This young lady perished in the canyon from dehydration and heat exhaustion. She was a marathon runner from Boston. If you think about it, Boston is a mild climate when they run the marathon. It's fairly level. There's lots of water, and it's very doable. You come to the canyon, that's just not the case. It's at elevation. It's 7,000 feet. It's a vertical mile to the bottom, and then you've got to get up. And the temperature can range 20 or more degrees at the bottom from what it is at the rim. In the summer, this past summer, it reached 140 degrees inside the canyon. It was 105 when she ran her canyon run. She had a friend with her. The other mistakes it says she made is they separated. But it's a tragic story, but it's kind of an analogy that explains being fitted to the environment or being prepared. There's another sign they have at the canyon. And I actually thought about this. I had to ditch cancel a trip after one night. I got off trail and I sprained a muscle and I thought about this. It's like, okay, I guess you're right. Getting to the bottom is optional. Getting to the top is mandatory. And so I thought about that and I said, I'm getting out of here because I just wasn't in shape. And there's no shame in that. I would like to make an analogy and reword this and say something like, solving global warming is mandatory, everything else is optional. So, how do we survive in nature? Life survives through competition with the external environment, with other species, and with competition with other individuals within our own species. So how are we doing with that? We seem to have neutralized the competition with the external environment. We have comfortable buildings, comfortable homes, automobiles, planes. But that's really short term. If you look long term, we've actually caused a global rise in temperature. So we've neutralized competition with other species, but the cost is we've lost biodiversity and resiliency. And I would argue we've actually increased competition between individuals within our own species by increasing population and competition for resources. Joseph Campbell reminds us that the paradox of nature is that life lives by killing and eating itself, as cruel as it sounds, casting off death and being reborn like the moon. The serpent represents the primary function of life, mainly eating. Life consists in eating other creatures. The serpent eating its own tail. So coming back to Jonas Salk, what he suggests is to serve nature in order to serve ourselves. And it may not seem so obvious, but this is where the wisdom comes in. So, a few examples of the power of art. This is just to illustrate the power of art. I probably don't even have to do this. We've had art before. We've had agriculture. And so I just wanted to go through a few examples. These are ads from the 50s and 60s that showed us how to live with our new appliances and our happy home. And the kitchen was the center of the home, and the housewife was always there. And then we had TV shows. This is the cast from Father Knows Best in 1959. We had TV shows that showed us how to live the suburban life and what to do and what to say, and the wife stays home and what the father does. But there was another America we really weren't talking about. And there was a war we weren't talking about. This is one of the less gruesome pictures from that era. And of course, the Cold War. I never witnessed an atomic bomb go off, but I can tell you this is terrifying to me. So this is a corporation, a campaign. Keep America Beautiful was incorporated in 1953. It was to, actually, I read a critique of this recently, and the critique was that it was founded by corporations such as Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, Anheuser-Busch, and Philip Morris, and it was an attempt to maybe shift the responsibility of containers, cleaning up the environment to the consumer, so, and also an attempt for the corporations to sidestep some regulation. Also, this man is not an American Indian, he's of Italian descent. And who can forget this? This is, of course, what inspired Earth Day in 1970. This is Apollo 8 moon mission taken in 1968. And for the first time, we got to see this little blue marble, the finite world we live on, and this is all we have. 1984, who better than Apple to upset the status quo with a woman throwing a hammer in the face of the establishment? Unfortunately, this is seared into our minds now. It has turned our world upside down. It changes the way we think about war, the way we think about security, the way we travel. It's very powerful, affecting our worldview. And events like this, 05, Katrina, it seems that the weather gets stronger and stronger. But a picture like this conveys a lot to illustrate that. So now, how has nature been treated throughout art history? I wanted to take a look at that. This is Lascaux, of course. This is from about 17,000 years ago. It's believed, it's not much known about it, but it's believed it was a sanctuary for rituals. These animals were important for the diet of the people at that time. So this is my thesis. The depiction of nature in art history is a progression from being at the center of the cosmos in early hunter-gatherer cultures to maybe a sentimental backdrop or even trivialized or ignored in our technologically advanced urban life today. If you look at early fertility figures, which these are, from Venus of Willendorf on the left from 28,000 years ago, this indicates a female god. These are thought to be idols of worship, of fertility idols. Again, Lascaux. Joseph Campbell tells us that in these early cultures, the hunting and gatherer societies at this stage, the religion was animistic, and nature was seen as being infused with a spirit or divine presence. That's important. This was the religion. Nature had a divine presence. This is a recently discovered cave in Indonesia 39,000 years ago. And this is near the canyon, V-Bar V Ranch, more rock art, dates to about 1000 AD. But even in agrarian, early agrarian societies, the earth was seen as the mother, and the myths focused around her life-giving power. So, mother gods, mother earth. Big shift when you get to classical Greek, the high civilizations, classical Greek and Rome. The focus heavily shifted toward the masculine. Zeus ascended the throne, and the goddesses like Dionysus were demoted to lesser gods. This was a time when there was an interest in architecture and math. This is an illustration of the golden section that could have been used to design the pantheon. It's not conclusive, but it's a mathematical formula believed to be of ideal proportion. And then in 1490, Leonardo da Vinci drew this. He's trying to work out the proportions of the human body. It's based on a work by a Roman architect, Vitruvius, who thought the human body was ideal proportion was 8 heads high. And at this time, there was a blending of art and science, and no better illustrated than in the life of Leonardo. This is a work by Raphael. It's a fresco, the School of Athens. This is the philosophers of ancient Greece, Plato and Aristotle, are at the center. Also a little scientific overlay there. It illustrates a linear perspective where two parallel lines appear to converge at a vanishing point. This is another illustration of a linear perspective. And then I discovered a book by Mary Gerard, Brunelleschi's Egg, and she suggests that there was a gender bias of nature. And there was a shift in the concept of nature from organic, if you think of organic being early hunter-gatherer cultures, to the scientific. And so she's suggesting that nature was subordinated to science at this time. And could have the fact that we refer to nature as female could have something to do with that. I don't know if I go this far with her, but she talks about a rhetorical defeat of nature. I think the point here is that the artist is said to create a perfect beauty from a concept in his head. So she was quoting artists like Raphael that was saying he had to take drawings from several models to come up with an ideal model. This is Birth of Venus, Sandro Botticelli, circa 1486. Certainly could be considered a depiction of ideal beauty. This is Raphael, fresco. She also makes the point that during this time, nature descended from a divine, creative, and generative power to what she says a lowly aggregate of rocks, twigs, and clouds. Well, you could say a landscape. So instead of having that a divine presence in hunter-gatherer cultures, it's now a landscape. So just as we wouldn't say nature is our religion today, you couldn't say that this painted in the 19th century by Thomas Moran, a very famous painting, was meant to be a religious painting. No, it was actually used to promote the creation of Yellowstone National Park. And then you have works like this, Robert Smithson, Spiral Jetty in 1970. It's based on earlier work from indigenous cultures, but it doesn't have that divine presence again, is the point that I'm trying to make. It was based on this serpent mound, where this was actually a burial mound, an ascending off place for souls into the next world. Dates from about 1000 AD. It's in Ohio. And then we come to Andy Warhol. I really like the artwork of Andy Warhol, but you can see by this time our nature is kind of sentimentalized and trivialized. It's not a divine presence anymore. Here he's cannibalizing Botticelli's work from the Renaissance. Venus is now a pop art icon. This, to me, is, again, holding up a mirror to the consumerist lifestyle that I grew up in, and having the happy home and all the accoutrements of that life. And more recently, this is a street artist, Banksy, Shop Till You Drop. So it's all about consumerism and not much room for nature. So this is a quick review of everything that I've talked about. I don't know that I need to go into great detail. I'm sort of running out of time. I'll move past this. And this is my art statement. Given all that I've talked about, I see nature as inseparable from us, an animating force in the world, and not just a force to exploit. Nature is dangerous, nature is cruel, life-eating life. We need a healthy respect for her. Our concept of nature is just that, a concept, a mental construct filled with denial and delusions of our world the way we want it to be and not the way it really is. And I believe art does hold the power to reconnect us with nature and change those beliefs. And with that, I'll show you my work from, this is from Taos, 1981. These are pinhole photographs. These are the Great Sand Dunes in Colorado. This is Abiquiu, where Georgia O'Keeffe's home is. In the creek bed, I was run off. I said, it's a pueblo. It's actually a pueblo. And I couldn't take pictures. And he said, you can't take pictures here. And so I went in the creek bed and took a picture anyway. These are popular. I just love the way the light was sparkling on. They sort of ripple in the wind and sparkle in the sun. And these are little plastic flowers along the side of the roadside up in northern New Mexico. And this is out in Mora County. And these are just shadows. And I don't know, it's kind of like looking at finding shapes in the clouds, you know. And this was in Bandelier, the waterfall there, one of the canyons. They said, don't go beyond this point. So I went back in 2011, my 30-year reunion with Taos, and took some more with my digital camera. And this is where I took it, Taos Pueblo. A blurrier style. This was done in Turkey at ancient Pergamum. Also ancient Pergamum. These are columns, colonnade. This is Aspendos, a Roman theater in Aspendos, Greek, Turkey. And this was a waterfall. More abstract. This is more abstract of a garden in Pingyao, China. Also in China. Of course, the pyramid at Giza, pyramids of Giza. This is Rome. The Colosseum. So I blur it intentionally to remove the details so that I can, you know, play with it and make it into something so that I can actually make it into my own instead of just recording what's there. So that's the reason I blur these. This is in Amman, Jordan. That's a Roman Odeon. This is in Venice, the Doge's Palace. This is Hagia, Crete, and Romania inside the oldest wooden church looking out. Here we are at the Grand Canyon. Sunset. Another sunset. Sunsets are great. Best place is Hermit's Rest Trail, if you ever get a chance to go out there. That's where the sun sets in the west. You can see the canyon. It's an agave plant. This is Bridges National Monument. This is along the Tonto Trail while I was backpacking. This is along the Kaibab Trail. Another agave. Another agave. Water. These are rapids in Havasu Creek. Lots of color. The water itself is blue-green, and the reflections off the Orange Canyon walls and the greenery. It's in the blue sky. It's a lot of reflections. I need to go back. Take more of that. This is the trail in Havasu Canyon. And another abstract version of that. This is a trail of Montezuma's Well. It's kind of a sinkhole, a big spring. This is Mooney Falls, Havasu Canyon. This is Mooney Falls. This is Upper Navajo Falls, Mooney Canyon. Havasu Canyon again. This is a little seep, they call it. It's a little spring in the wintertime, froze up, and I made kind of an ice fall. A stand of trees that looked like it had been burned and then bleached by the sun. These are Wupatki Pueblo ruins near the Grand Canyon. This is like a window in the wall. This is the same thing. This is at the canyon in like November, snow in the foreground in the canyon, and the sun falling on the canyon in the background. I thought I would close tonight with a passage from my journal. It's very, very personal, but wrote it in the middle of the night, completely unfiltered. Move down my glasses. September 3rd, 2014, Grand Canyon Artist Residence. Why do people come to the Grand Canyon? To take pictures, to see the sights, to be with family and friends, to spend a vacation. I come to the canyon to feel alive. I sit at a desk job 5 days a week, getting weaker and fatter, and dying inside a little each day. I should be growing inside a little each day. I came upon two young women taking pictures of themselves along Bright Angel Trail. The one having her picture taken asked her friend, "Do you want me standing?" Just at that moment, I passed by her and I said, "Yeah, on your head." She looked at me a little surprised and gave a little nervous laugh like, "That was weird." As I'm thinking about it now, that's the perfect reason to go to come to the Grand Canyon. To stand on your head. To turn your world upside down. To get crazy. To be your crazy self or your quiet self. Your reflective, meditative, open, understanding self. To be your fully human self. Aware, alive, glad to be alive and breathing and seeing and living and loving. Connected with and at one with the canyon, people around you, yourself, and just being here, fully here. Tragically, people die every year in the canyon by falling off the edge. If you've ever been in an accident, you know how time slows down to a crawl and you see everything happening to you in slow motion, but are powerless to stop it. Physical death only comes once for most of us. Life is happening to us all the time. And most of the time, we don't even notice it. If only I could live as alive as I feel at the canyon. Take it with me, as Hemingway says, Paris is a movable feast. If only I could embrace death and fear so that life stands out every moment. If only that moment could be now.